I'd like to call the Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee to order for Wednesday, February 27th. We have two bills on the agenda today, members, and we're going to start off with a next-gen energy board report from Assistant Commissioner Poster from the Department of Agriculture. Mr. Assistant Commissioner, whenever you're ready, you can start your presentation.
All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time today. Hopefully everyone has a copy of our report in their bundle. First off, I want to send greetings from Commissioner Fredrickson. He is stuck in several feet of snow in Iowa. Otherwise, he would be here with us today, too. He sends his regrets. One thing that he really wanted to talk about before we got into the particulars of the NextGen report and the Biofuels Advisory Task Force was to talk about Minnesota's historic leadership in the area of renewable fuels. And Commissioner Fredrickson actually helped pen the original legislation to lead Minnesota's 10% mandate in the mid-80s. That laid the groundwork for a $5 billion industry that helped support 12,600 jobs and helps us create 1.1 billion gallons of ethanol around the state. And the presentation that we're going to do today is really aimed at maintaining that leadership that we've developed over the past 20 years and allowing us to create a new industry while protecting the one we have for the next generation. So with that, we'll start and give a little bit of background on how this came about. The legislature over the past few years has discussed updating Minnesota's biofuels policies, but was not able to come to an agreement. So in last session, they asked the Department of Agriculture to put together a task force with stakeholders to look at our biofuels policies and how we can update them to reflect current industry practices. And as you can see here, we have the legislative charge. There are really three deliverables out of this legislative charge. The first one is to analyze research on next-generation biofuel blends that are in Minnesota. The second one is to provide information on federal approvals needed and also what the status of the federal approvals is for the biofuels here in state. And the third and the most important, which we'll focus the most on, is what is the policy recommendation of the group to update Minnesota's biofuels policies. So Commissioner Fredrickson started off our first meeting with the goal of making sure that we protect the investment in the industry that we have here in Minnesota. As I talked about, a thriving industry, $5 billion that supports 12,600 jobs. But we also need to make sure that we are making policy that allows that industry to grow into the future. So the goal was to protect what we have, but also allow growth into the future. The composition of the group was varied. We had three ethanol plants sitting on the board. We also had the Corn Growers Association, which is the provider of the most abundant feedstock for that industry. We had different biofuel companies, people making renewable gasoline, biocrude, and other biofuels. We had both University of Minnesota researchers and Minnesota State University Mankato folks, and we also had biofuel policy organizations like the Great Plains Institute and the Biobusiness Alliance, as well as AURI. We also brought back folks with years of experience, really decades of experience, Ralph Groshen and Larry Johnson, to sit on the board. So these are the three areas that we will talk about and give a brief overview on. The first portion of the report asks for an update on federal fuel policy. So we'll go into the RFS2 and analysis of Minnesota's next generation of biofuels. First, what is RFS? RFS is the Renewable Fuel Standard. This is our federal energy policy. It was passed first in 2005 and again in 2007. And it lays out the floors for biofuels use in America's liquid transportation in our country's liquid transportation fuels market. The RFS breaks fuel categories into four different categories based on their greenhouse gas reduction on a baseline against a baseline fuel, which is petroleum. So there are four categories: renewable fuel, cellulosic fuel, biomass-based diesel, and other advanced biofuel. This is a representation of both the fuel we use today in 2012 and 2013, and then what the growth areas are over the next decade. As you see, the green line shows the United States uses and produces about 13 billion gallons of ethanol per year. And over the next 10 years, we're going to continue our increased use of biofuels, but the growth is going to be largely in things other than corn-based ethanol. So this is the real opportunity for Minnesota to position ourselves to take advantage of the growth in those three other categories: cellulosic biofuel, biomass-based diesel, and other advanced biofuels. The fuels produced in Minnesota are, of course, ethanol, but we also have plants that have produced isobutanol, which can be blended at 12%, in contrast to ethanol's 10 and 16. It's commonly called just isobutanol 12 or isobutanol 16. We also have folks who are working on renewable gasoline, cellulosic biofuel, and biocrude. This might be a good point that the task force looked only at gasoline replacement in contrast to diesel. The legislative charge said, stated that we should focus on spark ignition engines. So we are looking only at things that can be blended with gasoline. The second deliverable in the report was the federal approvals process. So to be approved and used in the transportation marketplace in the United States, you have to be tested first for system compatibility. That's the first test, but not the last. And to be approved, you have to prove that you are substantially similar to a baseline fuel. The baseline fuel was gasoline in 1975. So if you can approve that your emissions are substantially similar to that, you would meet the first step in the engine marketplace. But if you can't, you can also receive a waiver. And of course, E10 received a waiver in 1978 for use in all motor vehicles. E15 received a waiver in 2011, but only a partial waiver for model vehicles 2001 and newer. So if you pass that first test on emissions compatibility, you still have to go through the second test, which is tier testing. This largely consists of monitoring the health effects data for the emissions of the tailpipe. You must go through tier 1 and tier 2 testing, but the EPA may require you to also go through tier 3. So for Minnesota, we're going to look at how the fuels that we produce here in state, where they are in that process of both receiving a waiver or being considered substantially similar, and also if they've gone through the tier testing. Ethanol received a waiver in 1978 and can be used in all vehicles. E15, as I talked about, received a partial waiver in 2011, which means it can be used in vehicles 2001 and newer. Isobutanol 12 is considered substantially similar, sub-SIM, but it still has to go through the tier testing and is currently doing that. Isobutanol 16 is going through the process of the first test, but it also submitted its tier testing in April 2012. Renewable gasoline that's being produced in Minnesota is considered substantially similar. It's chemically identical to gasoline, but they still must go through tier testing before they can enter the marketplace. The last piece, and I think what's relevant here today, given the bill that is up, is the policy recommendation. And yeah, I think it's important to note the goals that Senator Fredrickson, Commissioner Fredrickson, set out in the beginning, one-time senator, I guess. It's that we want to protect what we've already made in Minnesota and build upon it, not take anything down. So it was really important to him that we respect the incredibly strong rural impact that ethanol has on rural Minnesota, but then build for the next generation to take advantage of the RFS2 growth. So the recommendation, and we're very happy to say it came out unanimously with every single member of the group supporting it, is represented largely in this table. And I don't know if it shows well on the screen behind me, but the idea is that we slowly transition from an ethanol mandate to an agnostic biofuels mandate while also increasing the amount we use. So as you can see here, in 2013, the state of Minnesota is projected to use roughly 3 billion gallons of gasoline. And today, we will use 10% of that in ethanol. So slowly, moving from to 2025, we would increase that target to 30% of the marketplace, while slowly decreasing the ethanol minimum from 90% to the marketplace being open to any EPA and ASTM approved biofuel. So we would still have a biofuel support, but it would be open to any approved biofuel. And on the 30% number, I think it's important to note that the committee or the task force didn't arbitrarily just pick 30 number out of a hat, but rather most research shows that 30% is the number where you achieve the best efficiency and you are able to achieve potentially the best mileage in our vehicle fleet. The federal Congress has set some very aggressive fuel standards for the corporate average fleet, our fuel standard emissions, moving almost towards 50 miles per gallon by 2025. And to take advantage, to meet those really aggressive goals, they're going to have to take advantage of the higher octane that can be brought to the marketplace by biofuels. One other recommendation of the Biofuels Task Force is that we should look at policies to support both production of the feedstocks here in Minnesota, the production in Minnesota of renewable biofuels, advanced biofuels, and cellulosic biofuels, but also deployment of infrastructure necessary to meet those state blending goals. It calls for a task force, much like the one that produced this recommendation, to see what the challenges are in implementing both E15 and higher blends and the new biofuels that will feed into this marketplace in the future. This is a list of the members that sat on the committee, and it incorporates both existing blends today, ethanol producers, the producers of the next generation of biofuels, but also research organizations, researchers, and folks in the biofuels industry. That's a very brief overview. I'd be happy to answer any questions that we have now. I know that we also have some of the folks who actually sat on the task force also are going to testify about their experience.
Thank you very much, Assistant Commissioner. Are there any questions from members on the report? Thank you very much.
Much easier than 8 a.m. this morning. All right, well, thank you so much for the time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity. Following up on the report now, we have Senate File 448 that takes those recommendations from the report we just heard and actually puts them into a bill form. Mr. Chair, this has been a work in progress, and I do have an A3 author's amendment that would put the bill in the shape the author would prefer. And I think it's being handed out now.
believe we all have it. Thank you, Senator Sparks. If there's no discussion, Senator Sparks moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment prevails. And it is adopted. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 448 is the result of the Next Generation Board Biofuels Task Force work that took place over the interim. Minnesota has been a leader and needs to make room for the next generation of biofuels to continue to be a leader. Senate File 448 gives new fuels like biobutanol access to the marketplace, protects the investments we have made in the ethanol industry, and increases the goals of the petroleum displacement. I think that members saw in the report the group that was listed on the Biofuels Task Force. We need to thank Commissioner Fredrickson and his staff for all the hard work that they've put into this. I know it's been a long and hard road to get to the point we're at today, but I think it is an exciting point. I know we have a long list of testifiers, and so I think what I'd like to do is bring up Adam Schubert, Mr. Chair, and have him talk a little bit more about the bill and what's involved with this Senate file that's before us today.
All right, Mr. Schubert, please, for the record, can you state your name?
Yes, my name is Adam Schubert, S-C-H-U-B-E-R-T. I'm here today representing Butamax Advanced Biofuels. I'd like to firstly thank Senator Sparks for his leadership in introducing this bill, and I'm happy to have the opportunity today to speak in support of it as soon as I can work the technology. So, I am the Strategy and Regulatory Affairs Manager for Butamax. Butamax is a joint venture of BP and DuPont, which is focused exclusively on the development of biobutanol, focusing initially on the gasoline market. In my testimony today, I'll give you a quick introduction to Butamax, a discussion of why butanol should be of interest to Minnesota, and then explain our support for this bill. Very briefly, Butamax was founded in 2009, but is the result of a cooperation between BP and DuPont that dates back nearly a decade, with DuPont bringing their expertise in biotechnology and approaching BP looking for ways to develop a new biofuel that could provide the potential for overcoming limitations in vehicles and infrastructure to enable the growth of biofuels beyond what was possible on the solid foundation that was created with ethanol. We set to work in 2003, developed the technology. Butamax was created when a view of commercial success was found. Since then, we have built a demonstration plant to produce the product at scale and debug the technology to the extent that we will be in a place that later this year we expect to break ground on our first plant, which will be a retrofit of an existing ethanol plant, and have our first production at commercial scale by the end of next year. We see Minnesota as being a fantastic place to produce butanol. Because of its leadership in the biofuels industry, it has the workforce, the talent, the resources, and the capital assets, the ethanol plants on the ground that can be economically retrofit to be a very, very favorable place for us to launch our technology. However, under current law in Minnesota, we cannot market the product in gasoline sold in Minnesota, and that is the reason for our support of this bill. Let me talk a little bit now about how we came to target butanol and the value that it brings. In selecting butanol, the scientists from DuPont got together with the scientists from BP and looked at what are the sorts of things that can be made via biotechnology using all of the advances that have happened in the last 20 years to improve on the technology, the fundamental fermentation technology that's been around for millennia. We then took BP's input on what sorts of molecules would work well in gasoline, mix well with the gasoline molecules, be compatible with the vehicles that are already on the road and the distribution infrastructure. Where those two circles overlapped was butanol, and hence our focus there. But that's a theoretical start. Now how do you make that practical? So the first thing is, in order to be useful for a market the size of the fuels industry, you have to have abundant feedstocks to produce it from. Today, of course, that is corn, a place where Minnesota grows very well, very efficiently, and is very economic to convert to ethanol and other fuels, as the sugars derived from the corn starch are a very economic place to start. But butanol may begin there, but it won't end there, and that's because it can be produced from fermentation of sugars from a wide variety of sources. So as technology for converting such materials as corn stover, switchgrass, or many wood into sugars that are fermentable comes to market, and really many firms are working on that, including BP, DuPont, POET, many others. When that technology becomes commercial, we'll be in a place to marry our technology with it and further broaden the number of feedstocks one can use to make butanol. Next problem is getting to scale quickly is you need assets. And butanol is unique amongst many of the new biofuels that have been proposed in that we can produce it through economic retrofits of existing assets. The existing base of corn ethanol production in Minnesota and throughout the U.S. is the perfect place for us to start. You have businesses that have the right assets with need minor retrofits. You have staff and management that knows how to run those assets safely, efficiently, and we wanted to use those because that gives us a way to grow the business quickly. And to be clear, our model is to license our technology to the existing operators of those facilities because they're the ones that can operate it more effectively and efficiently than anyone else possibly can. Lastly, we'll be introducing butanol into a market where ethanol is already widely used. And so you need to be able to economically manufacture it. And that's really where we're at right now, is fine-tuning the technology to get to a price point where a refiner, looking at their options for compliance, if given that option, would choose butanol because it's the most economic way for them to meet their requirements for the marketplace. That is, in nutshells, how we came to choosing biobutanol as a target for our efforts. Thinking from the viewpoint of our stakeholders, what biobutanol provides to the oil companies, firstly, is an economic biofuel that they can use. Why it's economic, not only from its manufacturing costs, and the fact that it has favorable blending properties, low vapor pressure, high octane, favorable distillation. So it enables the refiner to produce gasoline at a lower cost to blend with the butanol. In addition, it can yield a higher volume of gasoline out of each barrel of crude oil. For the automakers, our focus has always been on a fuel compatible with the existing fleet, and we've tested the product extensively, over 1.5 million miles on vehicles, old, new, big, small, high mileage, low mileage, the full range of the marketplace to assure that butanol indeed is capable of meeting that requirement. For policymakers, it's about growing the biofuels in the marketplace in a way that's most cost-effective, does not penalize consumers, and for all obligated parties, works efficiently We believe by building off the existing value chain, leveraging existing investment, creating a molecule that fits well in the existing supply chain, we go a long way to fulfilling that idea. Lastly, for the biofuel producer, it allows them to take their existing asset with minor modifications and produce a higher value product, a product with an opportunity to grow the market for their production and do that economically. We expect the biggest market by far to be in gasoline, but there are additional markets that may develop as well in the chemical space. So where are we at Butamax in actually bringing this idea to fruition? As I mentioned earlier, we built a fully functional, fully integrated demonstration plant located in the north of England. We've been running it for 2 years, improving our technology, testing and retesting every possible scenario we can come up with how it might fail in the real world and coming up with fixes and assuring that before we launch it commercially, it will be robust. We've put 1.5 million miles on vehicles to provide confidence that it will work well in the existing vehicle fleet. And as a very real demonstration, product from our demonstration plant was used in last summer's Olympic Games to fuel official Olympic vehicles, a 24% blend in gasoline, fueling the official BMW cars used at the Olympic Games. Commercially, we're making substantial strides as well to make first production real. We've created an early adopters group of some of the leading existing corn ethanol companies because part of our story, as I said, is to get the volume quickly in order for this to be a real solution that works for the fuel supply chain. Our early adopters group has 8 member companies, including 2 Minnesota companies, High Water Ethanol, located in Lamberton, and Granite Falls Energy, located in Granite Falls. Amongst the 8 members, there are 11 facilities with a combined capacity of 900 million gallons. Substantial interest. All of them are reviewing our technology, and we hope in the next few months to announce where we will deploy it first. In addition to our plants, our competitor Gevo has, of course, already retrofit a facility in Luverne, Minnesota as their first facility as well. So a strong Minnesota connection for butanol altogether. And further on, Bagan Inc. is, of course, the company in Minnesota which has built more ethanol plants than anyone in the world, knows how to do it safely, economically, successfully, and they are our partner in executing the retrofits that we contemplate to get this into the marketplace. Regulatory approvals are key in order to be able to actually market the product. As Charlie mentioned earlier, we have submitted all of our necessary work to US EPA to get fuel registration. We did that almost a year ago and expect to hear back from them shortly. We know they've had some questions along the way. I think we've satisfied them, and hopefully we'll have a good answer from them in the very near future. California, of course, has their own regulatory requirements, which are of interest because of the breadth and scope of them. When they banned MTBE several years ago, they effectively banned every gasoline additive that hasn't gone through what they call a multimedia assessment, which is assessing all the possible air, soil, water, health impacts for the entire life cycle of the product, from manufacturing, transport, storage, and use. We're well along in obtaining multimedia approval from California. I mentioned that here to give you an indication of the rigor and thoroughness at which we are testing how our product will work in the existing fuel system and value chain. Other key parts of approval are ASTM, where at this point an ASTM specification for fuel-grade butanol is currently being validated. And Underwriters Laboratories, UL, whose certification for dispensing equipment is critical in our story. We are wrapping up a very thorough test program with UL. Testing is effectively complete at this point. They're in the process of finishing analyzing the data, and they, as an independent laboratory, will be reporting on their results in the next few months. We expect to have a very favorable report from them based on preliminary information we've seen out of it. So, this bill, Senate 448, in our view, as a butanol technology company, it facilitates Minnesota's policy objectives by allowing space for new biofuels to compete in the marketplace. And the key there is compete. It'll need to prove that they are economically efficient compared to other alternatives, which will still be in the marketplace. This law is necessary because under current law, we cannot market in Minnesota because of the way EPA regulations work and so forth. Thus, we see this as enabling a future where Minnesota can safely, economically grow biofuels in the gasoline pool in a way that works across the value chain and delivers some of the state's key policy objectives around fuel. With that, I'd like to thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Schubert. Members, are there any questions at this time? Any questions at all? All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Schubert.
Thank you.
We'd like to call Mr. Kletcher up to the testifier's table. And, sir, if you could, please state your name for the record.
Yes, I'm Brian Kletcher, CEO at High Water Ethanol. Kletcher is spelled K-L-E-T-S-C-H-E-R. Mr. Chair, committee members, first of all, I want to thank Senator Sparks for sponsoring the bill. Appreciate that. We are here to testify in favor of Senate File 448. A little bit about myself so the committee members can understand me. I'm CEO at High Water Ethanol. My prior experience also was a county commissioner in Redwood County for 12 years and also was a corn and soybean farmer for 30-plus years in Redwood County also. So I also currently serve as president of the Minnesota Biofuels Association and sat on the task force this past summer and worked towards bringing the report back and to NextGen. And also want to thank Commissioner Fredrickson and his staff for the fine job that they did. High Water Ethanol, again based in Lamberton, Minnesota, is a 59.5 million gallon permitted facility. We produce approximately 55 to 57 million gallons of ethanol per year. So we understand the production and the need for the biofuels to be able to expand within the state of Minnesota, if not our great nation. What this bill does for the ethanol industry and biofuels industry in particular is allows us to expand beyond what we are currently using. The opportunities, as you heard on the biobutanol, and High Water is one of those companies reviewing that process and the interest that it has sparked in us to be able to potentially increase our margins. And that's important in any business. So that review process is going on. But we also feel that the biofuels industry can grow much beyond that. And I think you've seen throughout the Senate file that ramping up from 10% currently, and actually in the state of Minnesota, we're probably between 11 and 12% when you include the blended fuels and the E85. So we're just about there to our first step already. So it's important as we move forward that we have that opportunity available for companies such as ourselves at High Water or other facilities that are interested in entering the biofuels industry. Without that, we will stall ourselves out in the biofuels industry and become stagnant. And I don't think that's any place where we want to be as a state. And I encourage you to speak in favor or approve this bill as we move forward. In the state of Minnesota, we currently use an abundant supply of biofuels that is produced here in the state. And that comes from 21 facilities that are based in the state of Minnesota. And granted, all those gallons do not stay here. But offering that opportunity that this bill does accomplish will guarantee jobs and future jobs into the future. And it's not just at our ethanol facility. It goes much beyond that. We have truckers. We have probably 70, between 50 and 70 vendors that we deal with on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month, year-to-year basis. And the employees that are involved in each of those that supply us ingredients and enzymes and everything else that goes along with producing ethanol. So those jobs are right here in Minnesota, and we need to make sure we maintain those jobs and continue strong moving forward. As I wrap it up, we have it in front of us, an opportunity to advance to places where probably 20, 25 years ago we didn't know possible. And I encourage and ask for your support and continue developing the biofuels industry. Thank you.
Well, thank you, sir. Members, do we have any questions for Mr. Kletcher at this time?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Dames.
Mr. Kletcher, welcome to the committee. And can you tell me, when you do your conversion, is that going to require you to shut the plant down for an extended period of time? And then also, how will this affect your employment base? Will this conversion decrease employment, increase it, or will it just stay the same? Or could you comment on that, please?
Mr. Kletcher.
Mr. Chair, a Senator, committee members, how it affects us. We go into a retrofit, my understanding. We've got many agreements to work out yet before we get to that point. But my understanding, when we get to that point and do a retrofit, we do the retrofit on the go. So we're not losing production of the biofuels that we currently have. What we do prior to switching over, we need about a 2-week to 3-week period where we need to absolutely clean everything out and then ramp the facility back up from that point and go back into our full production. Your second question in regards to employment, we anticipate that it'll require additional employees, anywhere from 2 to possibly 4 to operate the facility. That's still be worked out, but, you know, it's a small number. But, again, it affects our vendors. And more importantly, we continue to use corn that's produced right in our area. And we all know how Minnesota can produce corn, and we've proved that time and time again.
Thank you, sir. Any other
thank
questions?
You.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Kletcher.
Thank you.
Ms. Jarek, we have you on the list next. And if you could, for the record, state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Valerie Jarek, and I'm here today representing the Minnesota Ethanol Producers Association and the Minnesota Corn Growers Association. I've been associated with the Minnesota Corn Growers since 1990 when they formed their association, and have been working on ethanol since. And I think the only other person at the table would be Greg Knopf, who's probably done this as longer than I have. And knows a whole lot more than I do about it. The Minnesota Corn Growers and the Minnesota Ethanol Producers each had a representative on the Biofuels Task Force. We've worked a lot of hours and spent a lot of time trying to work this all out. We do support the bill. We thank Senator Sparks for carrying the bill. We have had a lot of discussion, even in the last few minutes, over the amendments, but I think we'll be continuing to work on this as we go forward. There has not been a single session since I started that we did not deal with ethanol issues, whether it was producer payments or environmental. There's always an ethanol issue, and I think we'll probably be before this committee. And if you serve on it for 4 years, I bet you'll see us for 4 years. Having said that, this is not a new idea. The corn growers were looking for a value-added product when they got behind the ethanol industry. Corn was less than $2 a bushel after the farm crisis in the early 80s, and they needed something to try to close that gap and do some value-added instead of shipping all our valuable product down the river. So the biobutanol industry will be using corn, and when and if we ever get it perfected and we go to cellulosics, which is being tested, and there are runs being made in South Dakota and some other areas, a plant being built in Iowa now, a fairly large plant, to use corn stover. They'll continue to use, we think, in the foreseeable future, agriculturally driven product as a feedstock. I think we've maybe not done a great job of getting our message out about the food for fuel issue. When you take 2 acres of corn and make 800 and some gallons of ethanol, you still have 1 acre of that feed value left because you have the distiller's grain left. You use about 33% of a kernel, but at the end, the food value is 145% higher than the corn kernel itself, so you end up with using about half the food value of the corn. So we're not really, you know, taking the food for fuel out of the people's mouths. Ethanol is, like I said, an old idea, and I was searching the internet for some information last weekend and saw where the first flex fuel vehicle rolled off the line in 1908, when Henry Ford made the first flex fuel car. So a little bit of information for you. With that said, I'll stand for questions.
Well, thank you, Ms. Jerk. Any questions among the committee at this time? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And next we have Mr. Jordan, if you could join us. And again, sir, if you don't mind stating your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Brendan Jordan. I'm Director of Bioenergy and Transportation Programs for the Great Plains Institute. I am testifying in favor of Senate File 448. Great Plains Institute is an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization focused on transitioning to a sustainable and low-carbon energy system. I personally served on the Biofuels Advisory Task Force. A colleague of mine serves on the NextGen board. In both venues, we supported the recommendations that became the basis for the legislation you're considering. I'm also here representing the Bioeconomy Coalition of Minnesota, and there is a handout in your packet listing our views on the mandate issue. The Bioeconomy Coalition is an alliance of bio-based chemical, advanced biofuel, agriculture, environmental, and other groups that support policy reform to grow bio-based industries in Minnesota. The coalition also supports Senate File 448. Why do we support this? Minnesota has had a strong and well-deserved focus on policies that increase renewable energy in the electricity sector. But it's also essential that we move as a state towards a more renewable and low-carbon transportation system. Along with investments in transit and more efficient vehicles, we also need cleaner fuels. Biofuels play a major role now and can play an even greater role in the future. Nearly all biofuels offer greenhouse gas reductions relative to petroleum. Nearly all biofuels are actually becoming cleaner over time and more efficient over time. While nearly all sources of petroleum are becoming more carbon intensive as we rely on more energy intensive sources of crude. By deploying smart public policy in the form of a producer payment program and enabling innovative entrepreneurship by farmer-owned cooperatives, Minnesota led the nation in creating an ethanol industry. But now other states, Mississippi, Iowa, Louisiana, Florida, Michigan, Kansas, are actually taking the lead in developing next-generation biofuels. Next-generation biofuels can include biofuels made from corn stalks, wood residue, garbage, even switchgrass. There are facilities under construction in several states making cellulosic biofuels. 2013, in my view, is the year when we are very likely to see commercial-scale production And it will not be in Minnesota. Next generation biofuels also include non-ethanol biofuels like biobutanol that you've heard a lot about today. And we do have some production in Minnesota and potential to have more. The industry is changing and evolving rapidly, and Minnesota should not be left behind. We feel that this bill represents an important step in embracing next generation technology. The bill does three things, as has been discussed. It broadens the state mandate so that non-ethanol biofuels can qualify. It does increase the biofuel goal to 30% by 2025, and it extends the life of the Biofuels Advisory Task Force and calls on it to recommend incentives for commercializing next-generation biofuels in Minnesota. All of those steps are important. It will be particularly important, in our view, for the state to take a serious look at what incentives competitor states are offering in making commercial-scale next-gen biofuel production feasible so that Minnesota can determine what they need to do to be competitive. It's important for me to emphasize that this bill, while it is an important step forward for the state, there will still be more work to do. The state will need to invest time, brain power, and resources if we are to attract next-generation technologies. And we will need a similar effort if we are to achieve the goals in this bill of 30% biofuels and gasoline by 2025. Nevertheless, I urge the committee to act favorably on this bill as one crucial next step. It will set Minnesota on a path to restoring its leadership position in a crucial high-tech industry, result in rural and metro job growth, and help the state reduce its transportation emissions. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of this bill. I'm happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you, sir. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would be a question either for Senator Sparks or Mr. Jordan, and I might have missed this in previous testimony, but could you just share a little bit about the size of the potential marketplace for Minnesota? What do you see is really what it could be in terms of dollars, and then where you think who are the leaders right now and what's the size of their industry, and just give us a sense of the opportunity.
I'm afraid I don't have precise numbers. I think it's a vast opportunity given the amount of money that we spend on fuels. And, you know, another opportunity, Senator Bonoff, which you're aware of in your district, is bio-based chemicals, which is very much in parallel with this industry, which is, a huge opportunity for the state. So any money that we're spending now on petroleum-based fuels could be money that could be that's all money leaving the state. So that could be money that stayed within the state. In terms of the leaders, I'm happy to distribute some additional materials on this, but there's a couple of really interesting facilities. For example, in Iowa, POET and DSM is building a commercial cellulosic biofuel facility in Iowa, as is DuPont. There are facilities under nearly complete in Mississippi and Florida. There's a facility, intriguing facility in Florida called INEOS that actually uses garbage. They gasify garbage, and then there's microbes that ferment the gas to produce ethanol. There's a facility in Mississippi called Keor, which is it uses wood waste and produces actually a synthetic bio-based crude oil that can go directly into an oil refinery. And that facility is also, as I understand, mechanically complete and expected to commission in the first quarter of this year. A lot of other projects I could name. I don't want to get into a laundry list, but there's really intriguing things happening around the country. I think on the biobutanol side, the leaders in that sector are in this room. It's Butamax and Gevo, both of which are active in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Any other questions? Senator Sparks, I don't know if you have any comments at this time or if we could open it up
to
further testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe before we move on, that's the end of my witnesses. And before we ask people, I apologize, I should have done this maybe sooner, but maybe it would be helpful if Senate Counsel, maybe Mr. Knopf, could just run through the bill. I know the Assistant Commissioner talked about the next-gen task force, and that's what we're trying to match. But I know there's been maybe a few changes, and maybe just a brief summary would help members, if that's okay with Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Knopf?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, that's fine. I'll try to engross some of the changes in the amendment because they do affect a couple. I did have a summary, and it kind of affects one part of that anyways, the way the amendment works. But in the first part, we're expanding the biofuel production goal to include all biofuels, not just ethanol. But then, of course, in Section 2, it's expiring in 2015. Again, you'll see later on that we have another goal, the petroleum replacement goal, which is kind of replacing this as the standard. In Section 3, that's the green economy definition, and that we're just adding the petroleum replacement goal to replace this one that we're repealing, and then also the 25 by 25 goal. Section 4 is advanced biofuel. That's a federal definition. I've got it in the summary. It does include biobutanol and other types of advanced biofuels. We have a biofuel definition that basically says that it has to have an approved pathway and be approved for sale by the U.S. EPA. And it would include both advanced and conventional. And then a conventional biofuel definition, which basically means it's ethanol from cornstarch. And in fact, if you look at the reference to the law there, that's exactly what it says there, too. There were some changes made to the bill in Section 4. I want to make sure people are very clear about that in the amendment. On 3.7, it's deleting or striking whichever is greater. And then on 3.6, it says at the option of the person responsible for the product. And why this is important is because currently now, if there's a maximum percent of ethanol that's higher than 10%, the industry would have to go to that right away or within a certain reasonable time frame. And what this does is gets rid of the whichever is greater and leaves it up to the person responsible for the product to determine which one they're going to do. Later in that section on 3.22 to 3.26, you'll see this was the percentage that Assistant Commissioner Poster and others have talked about, where we're scaling down the percent that has to be conventional or that we want to be conventional biofuels in the state from 90 down to no minimum in 2025. And we've made some other technical changes, and there's actually a technical that we need to do to the technical. But on 3.9, something got dropped. It was in an earlier amendment, and it was dropped along the way. But we'll fix that in grossing. It's not a big deal. Section 8, we're repealing the provision, the E20 provision in current law. In the summary, it says it's not needed now because there would be something else. But now we don't really have the something else because of the changes made to Section 7. But the E20 is a provision that would have gone away in a year or two anyways without being repealed, but it is being repealed in this bill. Paragraph B, we're again deleting that reference to Subdivision 1A, which is the E20, and then also allowing for federal registration in addition to the federal waiver. Subdivision 9 is technical, again, dealing with a repealed section. Section 10, several people talked about increasing the petroleum replacement goal. Again, and this is a goal now that will be used throughout. And basically, you can see the existing goal had 20% by 2015. This is trying to be a little more reasonable with the 14% by 2015 as far as kind of what's, now that we're a little closer to that, what's reasonably possible. And then it goes to 30% in 2025, you can see in the top of page 5. And this also talks about the commissioner, under the commissioner's power, the three commissioners basically, to continue to the task force. I think it was mentioned by one of the witnesses. And then also one of the issues is they're on 5.29 is they're adding a duty of facility in the production use of advanced biofuels, which again, there is a definition in the summary. And then it will expire, that task force expires in 2015. And then Section 11 is the repealer. And you can see, yes, that should be on the back of your bill. And that is the E20 mandate that would otherwise expire on December 31st, 2014, if not repealed here. As I understand it, none of those things will probably occur by that date, the requirements that are in here for it to take effect.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Senator Sparks, do you have anything further to say at this point?
Not at this point, Mr. Chair. I think that Senate Council did an excellent job. Thank you. I know that amendment kind of came at the last minute, but again, we're trying to work this through, and I know it's an important piece of legislation. I think it's important, obviously, that we maintain and protect the ethanol industry. But to Senator Bonhoff's point, I think that if we don't move forward and start to allow some of this next generation come in, that we might be passed up or it goes to other states. And obviously, all Minnesota benefits from the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and our reliance on fossil fuels. So I think this is a very important bill. That's the end of my testimony. I don't know if anyone else would like to be heard on the bill, Mr.
Yes,
Chair.
If there's anyone else in the audience who would like to speak for or against the Senate file, please take the witness stand. All right. Otherwise, is there any discussion on? Oh, do we have some testimony? You could state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matthew Lemke. I'm here on behalf of Flint Hills Resources. And I just very briefly, I just wanted to comment that we're working with the author. We appreciate him including a few things in the amendment that to address some concerns that we have with the bill. And going forward, we're going to continue to do so and work with the author to make sure that there's no unintended consequences and nothing runs afoul of any federal law or have unintended consequences with the marketplace. So we appreciate working with the author and look forward to doing so going forward. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Lemke. Anyone else? Yeah, please. And again, if you could state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Kevin Tolman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. Our members own and operate about 2,000 of the 3,500 convenience stores in Minnesota that sell gasoline at retail. I had intended to come and speak to the bill with several different concerns, but several of the concerns have been addressed in the amendment, and our main concern was that this was going to be an E15 mandate. The E15 mandate would be a concern of ours because our tanks that handle and our pumps that dispense the fuel are only rated, UL rated, to E10 currently. An E15 mandate would force us to take the pumps and the tanks and replace them at considerable cost. And I have a member of our association here, Steve Rush.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
Mr. Rush.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Steve Rush. I'm the Director of Government Relations for Holiday Companies, the Bloomington, Minnesota-based privately held convenience store company. We have slightly over 200 corporate stores in the state of Minnesota, and I'm proud to say of those units, 52 locations do sell E85, making us one of the largest biofuel retailers in the state of Minnesota. As Kevin alluded to, a serious source of concern that we had was that it would mandate something in excess of E10 or E15. Other than my 52 E85 pumps, all the rest of my equipment would be non-compliant, and I'd have to upgrade from E10 equipment to E15 equipment. Just the dispensers alone, those are very expensive. Those are about at least $20,000 per dispenser. And if you look at 5 or 6 dispensers per location times 200 or times 20,000 times 200 stores, that's obviously a big price tag for us. So we were very concerned that somehow we would be looking at a higher mandate. You know, there's a couple of other questions I think that should be thought of as well. One's a practical impediment to me as a retailer, because if I start buying or blending 90% gas with, say, 80% ethanol, or excuse me, 8% ethanol and 2% butanol, I've got to label my pumps that way. So right now when they say 90% gasoline, 10% ethanol, every time I change that blend, I've got to relabel all those in order to be in compliance with weights and measures. And that's very difficult for retailers. It's a chore that you have to do, but it's something that you have to think about when changing your blends, because then you have to run out and change all your pumps. Another thing that really concerns me is that when you look at your owner's manual for your vehicle, typically it will tell you you can put a product in your tank of 90% gasoline, but I believe the manufacturer's language refers to ethanol. So in terms of warranting the actual engine, I'm not sure if GM and Ford and Chrysler and all the auto manufacturers would take the position that that's an illegal or a fuel that they're not going to warrant for purposes of operating your vehicle. And, of course, if that were to be the opinion of the auto manufacturers, that would be a major source of concern for motorists in Minnesota. Those are all the questions or comments I had. If you had any questions, I'm happy to answer
them. Thank you, Mr. Rush. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for Mr. Rush. And, you know, first a comment to the second point. It seems to me the auto industry will catch up because, you know, we'll have to work that out. But with regard to the signs on the pumps, would there be any ability if, you know, if laws were changed to give ranges so that if there were certain permissible ranges of blends that you could say that you carry, you know, gasoline that falls within this range, would that be a potential solution? It seems, I agree with you, it seems difficult to have to make those kind of changes back and forth, but if they're all allowable and essentially quality equivalent, would that be a potential area to explore?
Oh, I think there's a great deal. Oh, I'm sorry, to the chair and the committee members. As to the labeling issue, I think there's all sorts of possibilities, and that's a great suggestion. I don't know how weights and measures would feel about it. They're normally very stringent, and I handle weights and measures compliance for holidays, so I'm certainly willing to talk to them if they're willing to be a little bit squishy on what I put on that label.
Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Rush. Any other questions here? Yes, Senator Davis.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, and I'd like to thank the Biofuels Advisory Task Force for all the work that you folks have done over the last year. I think we've come a long ways. I think we got a pretty good bill here, but I'm hearing there's still some issues out there maybe that need to be resolved. So I guess my question is, I know it wasn't just too long ago, they were still being talked about it in the hall, and as I understand, this bill will move to the Environmental Finance Committee next, but I'd like some assurance that some of these issues will get worked out, because I think it's very important that we move this bill forward, but in that same vein, we need to make sure that we're covering the bases we need to cover and get a good bill. And this is a committee where that kind of needs to come out of. So I'd just like to have some assurance that, these things are going to get worked out and we'll get this bill moved forward so that we got all the stakeholders participating and comfortable with where we're going. So if somebody could address that, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, I thought we were getting closer, and I think you heard from Mr. Lemke, and we've had many, many discussions with Mr. Tuma, and I think this amendment was an effort to try to get there. I think if you look in the summary, we don't talk about a mandate at all. It's all goals. But ultimately, we want to make sure that as we all have farmers in our districts, we also have many local convenience stores as well. So I think if many of you know me in my tenure here in the Minnesota Senate, I've never brought a bill forward willingly that wasn't worked out, and you obviously have my commitment that we'll continue to do it. The bill is scheduled to be heard in environment tomorrow, but I will leave it up to the will of the committee. If you'd like it to stay here, we can keep it here and work on it, or we can take it to Senator Marty's committee, because I think it is very important, too. And I think that Ms. Quinn from the department, too, could maybe have some more clarifying questions, but I'll give you my word on that, Senator Dames, and other members of the committee as well.
Thank you, Senator Sparks. Senator Coonan, do you have a question?
Well, kind of a more of a comment, I guess.
Sure.
But Senator Sparks, I'm glad to hear you're working on these issues. You know, as farmers and corn producers and ethanol producers and, of course, potential producers of future biofuels, we want things to progress along properly, but we sure don't want to lose our retail outlets, too. So I think it's important to work on this. So thank you for that.
All right. Yes, please state your name for the record.
I'm Julie Quinn. I'm the director of the Weights and Measures Division of the Department of Commerce. And I just wanted to clear up, Mr. Chairman and committee members, a misperception. And I guess I need to have a conversation with Mr. Rush because I think he's under a misperception, too. Currently in the Weights and Measures Statute in Chapter 239, the labeling requirement is if you are missing the oxygen, if you have non-oxygenated fuel for specific uses. You don't label your ethanol content unless you're in the E85 flex fuel blend thing. Anything that meets ASTM D 4814 right now wouldn't need to be labeled, and butanol in would be allowed in that mix. It's one of the permitted oxygenates. So there would not be a labeling issue at this point unless the committee or the legislature decided to add a labeling requirement.
Thank you for the clarification, Ms. Quinn. Any additional questions or comments, discussion? All right. Do we have a motion? Yes,
well,
Senator
Mr. Chair,
Dames.
I would feel comfortable if we move the bill forward. Senator Sparks certainly has worked very hard on this bill, and I certainly feel that he will work very hard to get the stakeholders, get this worked out, and if it doesn't, we have other stops that we can work on getting it corrected. So I appreciate your work on this, Senator Sparks, and I appreciate your commitment to get these issues worked out. Thank you for that.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair and Senator Dames, I appreciate that, and I know that we will continue to work on this as we go forward, and I think we can get to that place.
Well, with that, Senator Dames moves that Senate File 448 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Environment and Energy. Is there any further discussion at this point? With none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed, no. And the motion prevails. All right, well, thank you, Senator Sparks. I understand you also have Senate File 320 before us tonight.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
I need to get it. Training.
Next, we have Senate File 320, which should be a relatively easy bill, but I think it's still a very important bill. Senate File 320 is an extension of the Minnesota Agriculture Education Leadership Council. MAELC is tasked with funding solutions to the challenges in agriculture education and provides grant dollars to education programs that improve the understanding of agriculture. The executive director, Dr. Henry, was here a couple weeks ago to tell us about their valuable work. The council, under current law, is set to sunset on June 30th this year. The bill that's before you, Senate File 320, would extend that for another 5 years. I would ask for support of this extension and move that Senate 320 be recommended to pass. If members have questions, we can certainly discuss it.
Well, thank you, Senator Sparks. Are there any questions or discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Dames.
No questions, but certainly some comments. This organization, Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council, is a very important council. It does a lot of work in the areas of creating agricultural educators and filling some of the positions we have open in our local schools as far as ag instructors and things like that. And when this was established, it was established to help with that. They've done a great job. And this year alone, I think right now we have 8 different schools that have open ag departments. They don't have instructors. And this is one of the ways that we can fill that. So I would wholeheartedly support the Senator Sparks' movement of this bill.
Thank you, Senator Dames. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Sparks has moved that Senate File 320 be recommended to pass. Without further discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you. This committee is adjourned.